Before I introduce the speaker, I would just like to remind you that next week our speaker is Professor Stanley Coren of the Department of Psychology, and his topic is how dogs think. Some cat lovers may think that this is a contradiction in terms, but Professor Coren is going to assure us that it isn't, and there's one dog down here who's already declared an interest in coming, and I'm sure he's going to be here next week with his master. One more thing, you will have seen, those of you who are not members, you will have seen somebody taking memberships just outside the door, and if you feel like becoming a member, can you hear me all right? Okay. This is one I really have to talk about. if you should feel like becoming a member, we would welcome your membership if you've not already joined. It's a very economical membership, and it does a lot to help us bring speakers in and from time to time provide coffee and cookies after the talk is over. We can't do it every week, but we do it whenever we can. So your membership would be welcomed. It's $10 for students, $20 single, and $30 for family. This is a special lecture, as you may see by the sign behind me. This is the culmination of Celebrate Research Week at UBC. It's the end. There have been a number of events this week, as some of you will know. UBC has an extremely successful research program, and they have provided a special event speaker. Who is the speaker that we have here tonight? This is the UBC Research Excellence Lecture. Our speaker, as you will know, it's not going to be a surprise, is John Robinson, who was until fairly recently the director of the Sustainable Development Research Initiative, and he decided that he'd like to have a little more time to do research, so he stepped down from that a few years ago. He was educated at the University of Toronto as a geographer. His thesis was entitled Both Feet Planted Firmly in Midair, an Investigation of Energy Policy and Conceptual Frameworks. This was completed in 1981. Perhaps he'll tell us this evening what's changed since then and where our feet might be planted now. He's been very busy while here. I don't have time to go through all of his involvements, but since he came here in 1992, he is involved currently on the advisory council of the David Suzuki Foundation. He's on the board of the West Coast Environmental Law, the Sustainable Cities Foundation, a coordinating lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and he's currently a member of the Ministerial Advisory Panel on Sustainability for Public Works and Government Services Canada. He was involved in developing a special program. This isn't in the notes that he gave me, but I noted, I guess it's sort of alluded to, John, in developing a special program which allows us to put in what we think is important and then see at the output what impact that has on the environment. It's a program called QUEST. I noticed that there was a link to it on the web, and I was told that I could use it. But when I actually got there, I saw the demonstration drum, but I found much, I think to my wife's relief, who had some other ideas for what I should be doing this afternoon, that I couldn't actually access the program and try using it. But we're in for a very exciting, interesting, and challenging lecture this evening, and I welcome John Robinson, who's going to address us on accelerating sustainability in British Columbia.
I hope this is working. Can you hear me all the way at the back? Good. Well, I'm honored to be here, and I'm particularly happy to be here to represent Research Week at UBC, and because the Vancouver Institute has brought in so many exciting and excellent speakers, I'm honored to be numbered among that group now. But I'm also happy to be here because what I want to talk to you about tonight is something pretty close to my heart. And I think it's something really exciting, and it's something that UBC is a leader in supporting, and that is research that is intended from its beginning to be connected to societal problems. It's driven by those problems, and the passion of the people doing this kind of research is to make a direct contribution out in the world. So this is a form of interdisciplinarity that is problem-driven. And I want to talk to you a little bit about one aspect of that kind of work that we're doing and that we're pretty excited about. And that's the Center for Interactive Research on Sustainability. I'm going to do that, if you don't mind, because I think it's a little dark, so that might make it a little better view. We're not all that thrilled with the name, so you might be happy to know there will be a prize for the best acronym. We want to start with the acronym and work back to the name, so we want a really good acronym for the center, so feel free to submit. We don't know what the prize is yet, but it'll be something wonderful. The purpose of the center, which really, in many ways, is the culmination of about 25 years of thinking about how do we change the world? How do we make a significant difference in a fairly short time frame, given that we don't have several hundred years to figure out how we're destroying the planet and making people's lives miserable? We have actually a shorter period of time in which to engage with that problem. So a number of us started thinking a few years ago, and really the CSIRS project came together when I had a meeting with Peter Busby, who some of you may know as an architect in town, just won the Order of Canada last fall for his work on green buildings. And basically the two of us sat down and tried to decide what would be the coolest thing we could do with the rest of our lives. And this is what came out of that. And so you can decide by the end of my talk tonight whether you think this is a cool thing to do or not. The premise behind CSIRS is that sustainability is happening quite rapidly in many different places. It's popping up all over on a sort of spectrum ranging from a kind of greenwashing marketing of sustainability that isn't very solid or real on one end of the spectrum, right across to very serious attempts in NGOs, in government, and in industry to try and figure out what this beast is and make it happen. There's a very wide spectrum. However, although it's happening frequently, most governments at most levels now have sustainability strategies, almost all large companies have resources devoted to this, and so on, it's happening in episodic and ad hoc and partial fashions. It's not happening in an integrated way. And our view is that sustainability has to become a little more than little isolated instances. It has to start to penetrate the core of what we do and how we behave in all sectors of society. So we need to somehow figure out a way to accelerate sustainability. That's the fundamental purpose of the CSIRS project, to take these individual isolated instances and try and figure out a way to catalyze, to crystallize the process so that it starts to become a much deeper and broader and wider movement through society. So again, this is the litmus test. You can judge by the end of the 25 or 30 minutes from now whether you think what we want to do will in fact accelerate sustainability, because we think that that's what we should be judged on. And you'll see why I say that in a minute. Our vision, this is the modest version of our vision. So we're being very Canadian with this. We just use the word North America up there when in fact our ambitions are much more grander than that. But for now, we're only going to claim that this building will be the most advanced, the most innovative, and the highest performing building in North America when it's built. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about what that means. But I want to point you to the second half of what it says up there, because this is the crucial thing. Buildings are one thing, and building sustainable buildings is a good thing. However, creating little islands of sustainability in a swamp of business as usual and standard operating procedures is not going to get us there. So we have to start thinking of these buildings as themselves catalysts for a much broader process of urban design and urban form. And really, that's the level that we have to start penetrating, is the level of urban design. Now, you may ask, why urban? There's a lot of people living outside cities. What about the rural systems of the world? We've chosen to focus on urban, and we've chosen to focus initially on Canada, although, as I'll say a few minutes later, we have bigger ambitions than that down the road. But we've chosen to focus on that for a very simple set of reasons. These are very familiar charts to many of you. This is the UN's 2005 projections of global population growth. This is a really optimistic story. These numbers are way lower than they were when I was doing undergraduate environmental studies at U of T about 30 years ago. So this is a very optimistic story. The feeling is that we are going to be getting close to leveling off by the year 2050 at about 9 billion people. And every 2 years or so, that number comes slightly down. That number is much lower than it was in past projections, mainly because of unanticipated speed in the drop in fertility rates. That's what's really driving these lower numbers. However, despite the fact that this is a more optimistic view than we would have seen 10 years ago in projections from the same organization, it's non-trivial. 9 billion people is a 50% increase from the year 2000. We're going from 6 billion to 9 billion in 50 years. And the crucial point I want to make about that is every one of those additional people between the year 2000 and the year 2050 is going to be in a city. Rural population growth is going to be zero over the period from 2000 to 2050, according to these projections. There's, of course, uncertainty. Nevertheless, that's the UN's best judgment. Zero growth in rural population. The urban population, which, by the way, passed the rural last year, for the first time in human history, more people live in cities than outside cities. That happened last year. In 50 years, or 45 years from now, it's going to be double what it was in 2000. So the urban population of the planet is going from 3 billion in the year 2000 to 6 billion. The rural population is going from 3 to 3. So all the growth is in cities, not because there's higher population growth inside city limits, because there's a massive rural to urban migration that goes on as people move out of the countryside for the bright lights in the hope of a much better life, which often, sadly, is not to be found. So the build-out of cities is the big story, and this is going to happen in 45 years, because as you saw in the previous slide, we're starting to level off in that median projection. That means that post-2050, most of the urban infrastructure is going to be built, and then we're into retrofit mode. And if you've ever tried to retrofit your house, you know that it's a lot harder and more expensive to do than to build it right in the first place. So we've got 50 years before we're into retrofit mode. We got 50 years to fix our cities and to house 3 billion more people in those cities. What that means is outside Europe, which is entirely a special case, where a rural urban population will stay level over the next 50 years, everywhere else in the world, urban population is going to increase substantially. That means that most cities outside Europe and some North American cities are going to double in that period, including Vancouver. So basically, if you think of a city, think of the Vancouver region now, think of twice as many people by 2050. That's what we're going to have. All of these cities have the same 10 problems. And these are huge problems: clean air, clean water, water supply, energy, land use, jobs, housing, transportation, healthcare, waste. Add personal security to the list. That's a daunting set of tasks that we have to address. We have to get twice as good at every one of these in every city in the planet outside Europe just to stay even. Staying even isn't an option. It's not an option ethically. It's also not an option in very practical political terms. So if we want to get about twice as good at most of these things in most cities, and the cities are going to double, we have to get about four times as good in all of this list across almost every city in the planet in 45 years. Okay? That's the challenge. That's what we've got to do. We don't have much of a choice about this. So that's the sustainability challenge. This chart shows you population density in Vancouver in the year 2000. This was actually a map from our Quest model. As John mentioned, we build computer games to engage citizens in thinking about the future of their region. This is the Quest model showing the Lower Mainland. We're now building them for 6 other Canadian cities across the country. That's population density in the year 2000. Here's what it looks like in 2040 if we're really good and really intelligent and the livable region strategic plan isn't completely destroyed by warring municipalities who are, even as we speak, undermining the principles of it because of the difficulty of growth management. That's if we're good. If we're not good at managing growth, that's what this region is going to look like in 2040. Now, those of you who live here, most of the people in this room probably can interpret that map. It's not a very pretty sight in terms of green space and natural areas. But the population underlying those two projections, that one and that one, is the same. So it's all about how we manage this process. Okay, so this is going to happen everywhere. This is the challenge that we're facing. How do we do all these 10 things that I mentioned? Oh, I can see what went wrong. There's a slide missing. How do we do these 10 things that I mentioned? Clean air, clean water, water supply, energy, land use, jobs, housing, transportation, healthcare, and waste, 4 times as well, just in Vancouver alone. And then multiply that across the planet. There it is. Out of order. That's the sustainability, the urban sustainability challenge. However, it's also the urban sustainability opportunity. Trillions of dollars are being spent as we speak on this build-out, just to keep up with the demographic and economic growth in urban regions around the world. These are some estimates of urban infrastructure spending in different parts of the world. Trillions of dollars. Our challenge, therefore, is to make sure that some of these trillions of dollars are spent doing these 10 things way better. Right? That's the sustainability challenge. The money's going to be spent. We don't want to go in after it's spent and try and fix the problem. We got to engage with the investment. That means a really direct engagement with the private sector and the public sector, one of which is setting the rules for this investment and the other of which is doing the investment. We have to engage with that process. So we can't do it all in CSRS, but we think we can take a piece of that agenda. And this is our un-Canadian slide, where we talk about world leadership, because we think that that's the kind of ambition we need to have. We think we can become world leaders in this region in 3 interconnected areas of applied sustainability. We already are the leader in Canada, some say North America, in green building. There's more LEED certified architects here in Vancouver than there are anywhere else in the country. However, it's not enough. And it's not fast enough, it's not integrated enough. What we have is a bunch of buildings being constructed around the city and around British Columbia that are way better than anything built previously, but it's not now standard operating procedure. It's not penetrated deeply into the commercial development industry, for example. So we have to do more on green buildings. Then, kind of my day job, building these tools to engage citizens in thinking about the future. The reason we think this is so important, and this should be one of the 3 thrusts, is that we believe politicians can't act without a constituency. Having lunch with the deputy minister is great, and it may, you may be able to convince him or her. Nevertheless, politicians will not act if they don't believe there is a political constituency for significant change. The market won't deliver if they don't have a customer base for the products that are more sustainable. The customers and the citizens are us in our normal life. We have to somehow engage ourselves in a conversation at a level that goes far beyond anything that's ever been done before, and thinking through the consequences of different choices and finding out where we could be. What we call backcasting. Forecasting is trying to predict the most likely future. It's a mug's game, you're always wrong. Even those population projections, which are in some ways the easiest to do, never quite turn out to be the way you think. What we call backcasting is about saying, where do we want to be and how do we get there from here? Because even if we could tell the most likely future, it's not likely to be the most desirable one. So how do we articulate a desired future? Well, the only way to do that is engage people in a discussion about the consequences of different choices and showing them what happens when you make this decision or that decision. So we think a higher degree of community engagement is essential precondition for any kind of serious political action on sustainability. And the third and most ambitious part of the agenda is to figure out ways to make this happen on the ground. As an academic, I'm a big fan of theory. However, sustainability has to be an applied field. It has to actually happen in a very concrete way. So figuring out how to create new forms of partnership, private sector, public sector, NGO sector, and research sector partners who work together to make sustainability happen on the ground in areas that we have some kind of regional comparative advantage, some kind of expertise, that should be the goal, and that's the purpose of this third area. Let me express this to you in a slightly different form, in terms of a metaphor. We think narrative is a powerful way to communicate to people. Most of these topics are very complex, multidimensional, quantitative information that's hard to convey easily. I think it's crucial to move into a way of discussing this that's based on storytelling and based on communicating to people where they live. So we're experimenting that with that idea. With the use of this narrative. And the narrative, or with this metaphor, sorry. The metaphor is the gap between intention and action in three areas. There's the gap, the well-known gap, between the predicted performance of technical systems and what they actually do when you build them and operate them. This is very well known in the energy efficiency field, for example, where there's these engineering models that predict how buildings will perform or how technologies will perform, and it doesn't seem to happen that way out in the world. This is a very interesting gap, but it's fundamentally about technical performance. The second gap is in some ways the opposite. It's the well-known gap between what people say and what they do. What the opinion polls tell us about people's values, about environment and sustainability, and what the sales figures for SUVs tell us about what they're actually doing in life. We're all guilty of this. I suspect even the most the strongest environmentalists in this room would be somewhat embarrassed if forced to stand up and talk about their daily consumption behavior. There's this huge gap between intention and action on the behavioral side. And the third gap is between what policies are supposed to do and what the politicians tell us they're going to do and what actually happens to everybody when they're passed and implemented. These aren't just government policies. This is also true of private sector policies and procedures as well. There's often a big gap between intention and action on the policy front. We think SIRS can be a way of narrowing the gap between potential and performance, between belief and behavior, and between implementation and policy. And that we think we have to start dealing very seriously with the interaction of technical systems and people's behavior. This is the nexus. We know, for example, in green buildings, we see a lot of behavioral sabotage as people build a building that isn't very humane, and so people have to sabotage it to make it a decent working place, thus undermining the energy efficiency or water efficiency of the building. So we have to somehow figure out how to address these technical issues in ways that are behaviorally sophisticated and that really reflect what people are interested in and willing to do. We're going to do all this in a new campus. This is one of the most exciting things about the SIRS project. We're not going to be located here at UBC. We're going to be located on a new campus just east of downtown. It's called the Great Northern Way campus. And the most exciting thing about this new initiative, this was land given by the Finning Truck Company. So it's the Finning Flats just east of, say, the railway station. The most exciting thing is it was given to four institutions. This is not a single institution campus. This is a campus which is UBC, Simon Fraser, BCIT, and Emily Carr. Now think for a minute of the incredible power of bringing the design and art and technology skills of Emily Carr together with the technical training and technology savvy of BCIT and the research intensive environments of SFU and UBC. These are cultures that don't typically work together. In fact, we're discovering all of the difficulties of trying to work together because there's very different reward systems, very different ways of managing time and so on. Nevertheless, in principle, it's very exciting. And it's particularly exciting if you read that text, which comes right off the website of the Great Northern Way campus. Notice how that text is really focused on getting out into the community, on interacting with partners in the community. So we're excited about that and being part of this. See the two themes at the bottom? The two themes are urban sustainability and digital media related to arts and technology, arts and culture. We think of that as just another form of sustainability. Everything's a form of sustainability. If we don't engage the arts community, then we're not going to get there either. I think that we've tended to think of the sustainability issue much too biophysically, much too focused on environmental science, much too little focused on culture and arts and narrative and performance and so on. So we think we can subvert the whole campus to a sustainability agenda. We'll be the first building on this new campus, so we want to subvert the whole build out of the campus as well and turn it into a sustainability oriented operation. This is the 9 hectares of land of the Great Northern Way campus, and we're going to be located at the eastern edge of it, just basically across the street from QLT, or it might be easier to see here. The area outlined in red is the new campus. The green rectangle is our new building, and you can see, look at this site. This is really interesting. Whoops. Let me go back. Oh, I'm having trouble. My pointer, I have to be delicate with. Notice this area right here. This is the biggest single brownfield site left near to downtown Vancouver. Millions of square feet of new commercial, residential, and industrial development is going to happen in this area. This is the big build-out in the next 15 or 20 years. The opportunity to turn this into a living laboratory of sustainability is pretty overwhelming. The campus will play a major role in this process. So by the time the Olympics comes along, just wait and see what we will have in the way of walking tours and demonstrations and activities about urban sustainability in Vancouver. On the research side, we have a cluster. We have three clusters of research. We have 40 researchers among the four institutions in these three areas that correspond to the three areas I told you about. So it's pretty exciting. This is where this culture, interesting intercultural experiment is going on as we try and forge coherent research agendas in each of those three areas. I should say that in addition to the research clusters, the 40 faculty, we have 10 task forces in a whole bunch of different areas, ranging from interinstitutional agreements to City of Vancouver task force to task forces on community engagement and so on. We have about 100 people on those task forces, none of whom are paid, all of whom are making significant contributions to make this happen. CERS is becoming a kind of a community and a kind of commitment on the part of a lot of people who aren't being given any overt reward for this. That's in many ways the most exciting part of the CERS program, is the willingness and interest of people to get engaged in trying to make a difference in the community. Let me just walk you quickly through each of these three areas. And I'll start with the concept of building as laboratory. We want to build a building that over the whole lifetime of the building, and we think this will be a very long-lived building for reasons I'll come back to in a minute, we want a building that every bit of it, the paint, the cladding, the glazing, the carpets, the furniture, the heating systems, the water treatment, Every bit of it is a research test bed over the whole life of the building, continuously evaluated and tested. Tested in two dimensions, the technical performance of these systems, but also the behavioral side. So we'll all be guinea pigs. Well, everybody will be issued with a little set of ears to wear when they're in the building. And everybody will sign a sustainability charter. All occupants of the building will sign a charter that commits them to working with us to make this building perform better over time. And we will be continuously monitoring that. You may know that in most green buildings, the part that gets cut out of the budget as money runs out and construction is ongoing, invariably what gets cut out? Because it can be cut out without impairing the operating of the building, it's the monitoring system. So we have all of these great green buildings and we have no idea how they're performing. So we're gonna be super monitoring, excess monitoring on this building because we really wanna know how this works and we want a building that's modular over time, plug and play. You unplug systems and plug in new ones as technology changes. You try out different configurations. So that's the concept of building as laboratory. Let me just describe to you a couple of the design goals that we're going to have, that we are building for. And I should say we have hired the consultants, structural, mechanical, electrical, landscaping, and so on. They're meeting every Wednesday morning for 2 hours, which is a very interesting exercise, trying to work out how to do all these things. We want paperless design. We want it for the obvious reasons of reducing paper use. But there's another factor about paperless design that's even more interesting, and that's error reduction. The more you have an integrated 3D model of the building, the more when somebody scribbles on the plans out in the third floor as they're connecting pipes, that information gets fed back to the integrated 3D model. The 3D model of the building also becomes a powerful communication tool. We want to create 3D models, put them on the web, have them in exhibits, show the energy flows through the building, how the water works, play with the different systems, and use these as communication and educational devices about CSRS. We will be a satellite of Science World. They're a partner of us. We see a lot of interactive display material that we can do in both locations. We've tried to convince the city not to have any parking at all at CSRS. We think we can substitute entirely by a sustainable mobility program based on transit passes, based on a car co-op program, based on bike lockers and showers and an educational program inside the building and so on. They're not going to let us get away with zero, but we think we're going to be way less than a typical building. Now think about it. This is huge in terms of cost of buildings. Parking is... The underground parking in this building would have been $2 million. We're not putting it in. If you can reduce parking, you have a very big economic benefit at the front end of new commercial construction. Why should building, we talk about buildings reducing environmental impact. That seems to me the old agenda, you know, reducing the bads. We don't want to reduce the bads, we want to create the goods. Why shouldn't buildings actually make the local and the global environment better because they exist? This is a non-trivial goal because buildings are full of concrete, they're full of steel, they're full of glass, all of which requires energy and materials to make. So to try and actually build a building that over its life cycle, looking at all the materials, is a net positive contributor to the environment, that seems to me like a good challenge. That seems to me the kind of goal we should have in buildings. They should all be doing this down the road. Greenhouse gas neutral, of course. We will have no net greenhouse gas emissions from this building. We were going to have zero mechanical ventilation, all natural ventilation. We can't quite do it. It's a very dusty site down there near the rail yards and the Great Northern Way. So we have to push the air in the building through some filters, very active filters. So we're going to need some low power fans, but they'll be really low power. This will be almost entirely natural ventilation. This building will be a net energy producer eventually. That's why there's an asterisk there. Why should buildings be energy consumers? You may know that the average office building, even in Vancouver, certainly in Toronto, in the middle of February, in the middle of the day, simultaneously on every floor of that building, there is heating around the perimeters because they're so badly insulated, and there's cooling in the middle of the floor because there's so many bodies and machines there. On the same floor, simultaneous heating and cooling all day. That's how we build buildings. It's insane. So why should buildings be energy consumers? Why shouldn't they be energy producers? We've already got in our energy modeling down to 80% below the Model National Energy Code through the design features that I'm talking about. And we're going to put out an expression of interest to the local industry, renewable energy industry, saying produce that 20 for us. And we're going to end up selling electricity back to BC Hydro. Think of an energy system where buildings are distributed through the grid, and they're producing energy. They're selling it back to the utility. That's a very different kind of electricity system than baseload generation, and everybody's a consumer. We think this is an exciting way to think about electricity. BC Hydro is also excited by this. They were the first big investor in CERS. They gave us $5 million over a year ago for CERS. Every inch of this building will be daylit. Daylighting, of course, saves energy when there is enough light, saves energy, but much more importantly, it improves productivity and it makes people happier. The labor cost per square foot in a commercial building is between 10 and 100 times higher than the energy costs per square foot. Tiny improvement in productivity, way more important economically than the energy savings. Productivity gains anecdotally are the most important thing you can have in a green building. We don't know if that's true, we want to test that. But we're going to have it daylit everywhere with light pipes and sun shelves and sun scoops and so on. There will be no water supply to this building. Surely to God, if there's anywhere in the world that you can live off water from the sky, it's got to be Vancouver. So we will have all of our water supply from the sky. Of course, according to GVRD, that's a toxic substance when it lands on your roof, so there's certain treatment requirements, but we'll do that. We will have a connection to the city because for fire suppression, you've got to have it. We're not going to actually fight any fires we have with it because we'll have our own fire fighting water, but we have to have a backup. So there will be a connection, but we will never use it. We will entirely be based on water from the sky, and none of the liquid leaving this building will be liquid waste. We will have full tertiary treatment inside the CERS building, inside and outside. So we'll have solar aquatics and a constructed wetland, and the water that leaves us will be clean. This is a harder one, solid waste, because this is very behavioral. This depends on people's behavior. So we're not sure if we can get to zero, but it's the right goal, and we're going to push pretty hard. Why not build buildings out of materials made directly by the sun? In BC, we should use wood for building materials more. It is the only building material produced directly by the sun. So we're going to have a wood frame building. This, of course, violates code in various ways. In fact, almost all of these things violate code. The city has exempted us from the building code to the extent that we can produce performance-based equivalencies for all the areas we would otherwise violate code. We think if we can demonstrate these equivalencies, nothing could do more to spur green building in this city than to get faster approvals for green buildings. Because in real estate, time is money, right? It really is. And right now, as you may know, escalation in Vancouver for construction is about 1.5% a month. That means on this building, $31 million building, it's $500,000 a month is the construction escalation that's happening because of the Olympics and so on. If you can speed up approvals, that's a huge factor. So we think these performance-based equivalencies are critical and will have a big impact on the building industry. Notice how this is a partnership with the city, the regulator, and the builders and us. This is this kind of intersectoral partnership I'm talking about. We want to have the cleanest air in the province inside our building. That's a big claim. As we want to have certainly much cleaner air than anywhere else in Vancouver inside our building. And this has health benefits. This also has happiness benefits. We want CERS to be a very nice place to work. To do all that, we have to have a level of monitoring and adaptive control that just goes beyond anything that exists, we think, anywhere in the world. We want to actually wire people into this building and so that they're actively part of the controls and monitoring system, because most green buildings push them out and give them no control over heating or cooling or airflow. And we think that disempowers them and makes it an unhappy place to be. We want to do the opposite, bring people in and engage them. They sign the charter, they're part of this feedback and adaptive control environment. And we want to test this all over the whole lifetime of the building continuously. So our concept of a building is green, where green doesn't mean just reducing bads, it means creating goods, positive environmental impact. We want it to be humane. A lot of buildings aren't very humane. They're not nice places to be. We would like to have a building where people want to be there, that they're measurably healthier because of the air quality, more productive because of the daylighting and other factors like the food provision, and therefore happier. We'd like to measure that and show that buildings can make people happier. Wouldn't that be the kind of building you'd want to work in, one that you feel happier in? We think that's the right goal. To do that, we have to be smart. Smart means cost effective. We're going to build this building, by the way, for $300 a square foot. That's exactly what other new UBC buildings are going to come in 2008, which is when we're going to open our doors. We're going to do all this for the same price. That's huge if we can succeed, because then we're demonstrating that all this kind of sustainability stuff isn't some gold-plated extra that you do if you have lots of money. Anybody can build a sustainable building if they spend $600 a square foot. But if we can do it for the same price, and we are able, if we're going to do that, it's because of the savings that come from integrating all these systems. Every one of the things I've talked to you about is in place somewhere in the world. But nowhere are they all put together. And when you do that, you see a huge savings. So you have to be cost effective, but you also have to be smart. You have to have control and monitoring systems that go beyond what we've done. As I said earlier, we're talking to two potential partners, Siemens and Johnson Controls, about a breakthrough in monitoring and controls and sensing technology that would allow us to have a level of adaptive management that goes beyond anything we think anywhere. You put all those three things together, that's what we mean by a sustainable building. Let me tell you very briefly about part two, simulation and visualization. This is about engaging people. In order to engage people, you've got to start where they are. There's no point doing all this wonderful modeling and then say, because I'm brilliant and this is important, everybody needs to know, so I'll add a little user interface and communicate it outwards. Doesn't work very well. It's been tried many, many times. It's not a way to get the research out to the community. You've got to start in the other room, the other end. This is actually academically disreputable. The kind of modeling we do, where we say, what do people care about? What kind of interface would actually address their concerns? What kind of models do you need to support that interface? What kind of data would drive those models? In other words, work backwards from the user, from society, into the academy. This is not at all science-driven by the literature. This is driven by the social problems. As I say, it's somewhat disreputable for that reason, but I think it's also potentially way more useful in engaging with social problems. We have, this is the science world, Weyerhaeuser Theater. We've added in every seat arm in the theater little button boxes. About 18,000, mostly students and teachers, have sat in that theater and played a version of Quest aimed at kids. And they would make choices by pushing buttons and see the consequences on the screen. We think that these new technologies of engagement can be very powerful ways of getting people interested in their future. The ultimate sustainability question is, what kind of neighborhood do you want your kids to live in? Right? That's it. It's not more complex than that. That's the sustainability question. Kids get very excited about this because they live in this kind of world. They ask questions that adults don't even understand about this kind of gaming and simulation. So they're a nice audience to work with. We also do work in immersion technology. This is the Landscape Immersion Lab over in Forestry that Stephen Shepherd and others run, where they show people forest harvesting in their own landscape under different assumptions. And you wouldn't believe how excited people get when they see the difference between different forms of harvesting in their own backyard. Combine those two last slides. We're going to have a 100-seat theater in SIRS with interactive touchpads at each seat and a 4-meter by 12-meter curved screen immersion environment at the front, where we're going to fly people through the future and show them the consequences as they make choices on their touchpads so they can see it on the streetscape. They can see what it looks like. They can see what the options are available. Sustainability is all about making a choice about where you want to be when you understand the consequences of different choices. And so this kind of technology can be a way of doing that. We're also going to do quite a bit of programming. We'll be doing on-site MBAs, sustainability MBAs, based with the Learning Strategies Group at Simon Fraser. BCIT trains 80% of the senior trades in this province. We know if you're going to make this stuff happen, it's got to happen at the level of the electricians and the plumbers and the carpenters. Because if they're not trained to do it, it doesn't matter how great the design is and what the architects say, it's not going to happen at the working level. So we think getting BCIT involved in doing sustainability trades training is a huge step forward. We're going to be doing community service learning. We're in cooperation with Margot Fryer and her initiatives in the Downtown East Side and some of the community service learning that's going on at the new campus already. And then finally, of course, we'll be doing our own courses. I'm teaching a course now on life cycle assessment in buildings, which is mostly engineers and architects and planners. Okay, part three is the most ambitious part of our agenda. This is where we want to start making a difference in a tangible way on the ground, beyond SERS itself, beyond the building. We can't do it all, but we can identify 8 to 10 areas that we in this province have comparative advantage in sustainability technologies and services. We can find 8 to 10 areas where we're kind of leading the pack, we're competitive internationally. Let's find those 8 or 10 ways and create the partnerships. The private sector, because the private sector is who does it all to the planet, either good or bad. All the damage that's done is mostly done by the private sector. They have to be, they're the delivery agent. They have to be part of the solution. The public sector, because if you don't get the rules right, it won't happen. The NGOs have to be involved at the front end, not at the back end, where they have to criticize and complain because ideas weren't thought of, but as social licensed to operate agents and agents of innovation, they need to be engaged at the front of the process. And then finally, research. We think there's a few issues that need further research, and there's a role for us at the university to be part of these partnerships. We want to make these 8 or 10 things happen on the ground in this region, as a springboard to the export market and urban infrastructure. That's that $1 trillion market. Now, it's not only a marketing agenda. There's also aid and development issues that we have to engage in seriously. There's really big ethical issues about delivery and transfer of technology around the world. But it's also about trade. And that's, of course, the hook that makes it interesting to the private sector. We want to create what I like to think of it as a sustainability mosaic, where you get partners together. This is just a list of organizations we're actually talking to. They may not all end up as partners of SERS, but they're all organizations we're talking to, including public sector organizations like City of Vancouver and GVRD, a bunch of private sector and NGO organizations. Each of those partners has a different, really strong focus, a core competence in business language in different areas. And so they tend to work separately from each other. We think SERS can be the kind of grout that connects these different areas together. And by doing that, by creating this mosaic, we create sustainability. So that's the concept of the partnerships. And we find, to our surprise, there's very little strong attempt to try and reach across these sectoral barriers. In this region and elsewhere. So we think there's some promise there. We want to have our partners as tenants in the building. There's a picture of phase one of SERS, and phase two is over here, which we still have to raise funding for. But in phase one, in the second wing there, and in phase two, we will be putting tenants. We have letters of intent from partners that add up to about 30,000 square feet of office space in SERS. We've only got 12 available in the phase one. So we're oversubscribed. There's a lot of interest in being part of this, this program. And we're pretty excited about putting together these kinds of groups and starting to seriously engage with making sustainability happen. But it's not just the building. We don't want little islands, as I said, islands of sustainability in this swamp of business as usual and standard operating procedure. We've got to think beyond the building scale, because sub-optimizing at the building level means you lose opportunities that might happen at the next level up. So this is a slide of the sustainability precinct we proposed to the city a couple of years ago. And it turned out they'd been thinking along these lines. They've jumped all over it. The previous council approved a pre-feasibility study to create a heat utility in the precinct. And that study is now, they hope to go to council later this year for final approval to build a heat utility that would supply heat in Southeast Falls Creek initially, where the Olympic Village will be. We're going to have our geo exchange down here in Sears, a heat pump, ground source heat pump technology for heating and cooling. Science World is planning its outdoor sustainability theme park up here. Here's the campus that's going to build out. The St. Paul's Hospital has been proposed to move over here. We'll see how that plays out politically, and so on. And the city is trying to buy all these rail yards and allow them to be developed as well. So there's an opportunity to think of a precinct scale sustainability set of systems, an energy utility. This is a slide I stole from the city that describes their thinking as of about 8 months ago for a multi-dimensional microgrid system that could involve electricity, so it's cogeneration, district heating, and various ideas about how to manage this. That's all still up in the air. So again, we want to think about nesting CSERS within this kind of larger neighborhood, and again, the neighborhood in turn, the precinct in terms of the city as a whole. So this all leads us to three outcomes. We think world leadership is not beyond our grasp. We think in each of those three areas we're at near the front of the wave, and we don't know anybody who's trying to combine all three yet. This is a huge opportunity for Vancouver to stake out some ground in the international sustainability stakes. The crucial one, real progress on the ground. What I've found, one of the things I've really learned as an academic is how important it is to talk about something tangible, something real, something literally concrete that you can walk in. That gets people, non-academics at least, quite a bit more excited than the sort of purely theoretical arguments that we've been making for a long time about this. And then this enormous export potential, which can potentially tilt. Think of the BC economy, which is proceeding on a path, not a very sustainable path right now. If we can tilt it ever so slightly in a more sustainable direction, that small change in direction has huge impact down the road. So we think that this is where we should be heading. And I'll end with a little description of our schedule. We have development permit is going into the city this month, and assuming we get all the approvals we need, we hope to be in the ground in about June and get to occupancy in early 2008. So that's the CSERS idea. You can judge whether you think it's a cool thing and whether you think it will really lead to any significant change. Thanks very much.
I'd be happy to take questions.
Sure,
could you repeat the questions?
I will. Okay. Shall I moderate, or will you pick? Oh, okay. Yes.
With such vast plans, you need someone rather than a committee to run this. How are you structuring this so you have essentially? I'll give you an example. When Simon Fraser was built, it was built by one man, Gordon Shrum. We don't have any Gordon Shrums anymore, but we need them for projects like this. Do you have anybody in mind that can do this?
Well, did everyone hear that question? We need Superman to make, or Superwoman to make this thing real. And we don't have Superman or Superwoman. So by default, the champion right now for CSERS is me. The advantage of that is that this incredible energy of the people involved in the project is what's carrying things forward. I'm in the enviable position of having no actual authority or power at all about CSRS, and so I can say anything and do anything and act as project champion without too much constraint. The universities have been very supportive. We have a steering committee, which I created about 4 years ago, which is mostly non-university people, and that's actually turned out to be quite important in putting pressure on the academic institutions. But basically, this is running off enthusiasm and energy by almost everybody involved. And so far, we've raised, if we sign the final few deals that we're trying to sign this month and next month, we'll have raised $26 million since 2003. And we'll debt finance the rest, and we'll build this for $31.6 million. That's phase one. Oh, I forgot to mention a crucial part. Phase two, of course, we want to build instantly, and we think we can do that commercially, because there will be no academics in it, no labs, it'll be just office space. Once we do that, we want to replicate CSRS around the world. We think that's a beautiful opportunity to take exactly the same principles and put them in a different political set of circumstances, different geotechnical, different biophysical circumstances, and then compare notes. So that's our even more ambitious plan for the future. And not too many people believed that CSRS would happen 3 years ago. A lot more do now. So I'm pretty confident that you will see that building operating in 2008. Yeah?
What you described is a worthwhile Canadian initiative, but I find myself harkening back to something you said at the very beginning of your speech in terms of the populations and urban growth. And you said that this, of course, excludes Europe.
Right.
And my question is, why?
Right. Europe is way ahead of us in many areas of sustainability, like way ahead. In terms of internalizing into the population at large, Germany and Scandinavia, it's far beyond what's going on here. When people move from there, they're surprised that this progressive Vancouver region, how far it has not yet come in that. Nevertheless, my argument would be that Europe is a special case both for demographic reasons, but also for reasons that they are consumer economies. The reason as to why they're not growing in population is they are not a source of massive in-migration. North America, it's migration that's fueling population growth. In other parts of the world, it's actual fertility rates that haven't yet come down to replacement levels. Europe has neither of those. So it's a stable, its population is roughly stable. And it's a consumer economy. We're a producer economy. We are an economy based on wood and mining and so on. We have the opportunity to articulate a vision of sustainability that will work for societies that are growing in population and growing, are based on non-renewable resource and renewable resource extraction. That's still going on around the world, those two things. If we can figure out a way to make that sustainable, that's way more useful to developing countries, I think, than the European model. So I think the kind of sustainability we can do in BC is potentially an extremely powerful form of sustainability. In the end, of course, we've got to transform even more fundamentally than that. But over the next 50 years, I think we can pioneer in BC a way of thinking about sustainability that will work and be more interesting in China than the European model, and in India, and in Africa. Yes?
I would like to ask a very simple question. You're very enthusiastic about your project. However, as a layperson, I found as you progressed, I become increasingly confused about what you mean by sustainability. Could you please give a brief description that a layperson might understand?
The slide I had up with the 10 problems was intended to be a form of that. If we can get four times as good at those 10 things in every city in the planet by 2050, we will have made big strides towards sustainability. If you want an actual definition of sustainability, I'll give you two, because I think there's a substantive issue and a procedural issue. The substantive definition I'd give you is sustainability is the reconciliation of three imperatives. We have to stay within biophysical carrying capacity. That's an absolute imperative. We have to provide adequate material standard of living for all. That's both a political and an ethical imperative. And we have to provide systems of governance that propagate the values we want to live by. That's an absolute social and cultural imperative. So I would say it's that we have to do all three. We can't just do any two of those three. We can be clean and wealthy and fall apart in governance. Not going to work. You have to have all three. So that's why I say reconcile these three imperatives. So that's the substantive definition. The procedural definition I'd give you is equally simple in some ways. Sustainability is the outcome of a conversation about what kind of world you want to grow your kids to grow up in that's informed by some understanding of the consequences of different choices. If you ask people, what do you want? Everybody says, everything. I want clean air and clean water and a nice job and a big house and three cars. You know, you just want it all. You can't have it all. So the point is that you want to talk about what kind of world you want to live in, but that talk has to be informed by some understanding of consequences of different choices. That's the procedural definition. So to me, sustainability is, as I said in the talk, the world you want your kids to grow up in when you understand the consequences of different choices. And that's why we're so focused on community engagement and gaming processes to get at that kind of question. Yes?
It's not clear where the money is coming from. Uh-huh. Private sector?
Yes. For SERS, the money, where's the money coming from? The money for SERS phase one is coming about 4.5 million from the Canada Foundation for Innovation, about the same from BC Knowledge Development Fund, which is a matching fund for the CFI, Canada Foundation for Innovation. About 2.5 million from Sustainable Development Technology Canada, which is a foundation set up by the federal government. Up 5 million from Terrace and Utility Services, if we sign the deal we're trying to sign with them. About 4 million from our controls partner, depending on who that turns out to be. A couple of million from our interiors partner, and so on. So it's a mixture of public and private funding. But for phase two, we don't want that model, because that's not a model that you can transfer out into the marketplace. We want phase two to be entirely financed by a private developer who will be paid back out of the lease revenue of tenants. And we have a private developer that's approached us to do phase two. So we think sustainability can be viable economically in the marketplace. And in fact, we think if it isn't, it's not going to happen. It just won't penetrate in a major way commercial development if it's not viable. So phase one is more research funds and government funds, but as we move into phase two, we want this to be self-financed. Yep. Okay, so the question was, the region is not living up to its goals in terms of the Livable Region Strategic Plan, and why aren't we engaging more with that issue? Is that fair? I think you're right, this is a big problem. LRSP worked, the Livable Regions Plan worked in terms of residential development, in terms of the growth nodes, but employment didn't. And so there's this mismatch now between where people are living and where some of the commercial development is and where the jobs are. And so periphery to periphery travel is becoming a huge problem. It's not center periphery anymore, people commuting to downtown Vancouver. It's actually from Surrey to Delta and so on. So we have a big problem to revitalize the Livable Regions Plan. I think it's absolutely crucial, because without that, we move into the second picture I showed of 2040, where sprawl takes over. I am an optimist about this. LRSP has been a success story. When we run our models of density, We tried to, with Quest, reproduce Seattle, which is less dense than we are, and we couldn't get there in 40 years. So we have made some progress. We are more nodal and more dense than almost all American cities and even most Canadian cities. So there's some good news there, but we could lose that. You're absolutely right. We could end up with the bad 2040 I showed you instead of the better one. If we don't figure out a way to make it in the interest of municipal politicians to act collectively. This is a big problem. Same problem we have at the university and faculties, actually. How do you get them to operate in terms of the collective good? I'm an optimist sort of necessity, because if we don't figure that out, we're in big trouble. So I have to believe there are ways to do it. And I'm also an optimist for demographic reasons. I've been doing this for a long time, and I can tell you 20 years ago, none of this would have resonated with any private sector person I talked to at all, or most government people. They weren't interested, they didn't want to know. There now is a whole generation moved up into middle and lower senior management that's grown up with believing we're destroying the planet, and they're way more open and receptive to these issues than was true when I was trying to make similar arguments in the past. So I am optimistic that there's way more energy, there's way more interest than there was in the past. Is it going to be enough and in time? Who knows? But I don't think pessimism is going to be more likely to get us there. Yeah.
To what extent will this be showcased at the upcoming World Urban Forum?
I am giving a talk at Globe. Sorry, the World Urban Forum. We're going to have on the campus, the Great Northern Way campus, a showcase. Judith Marcuse's Earth Project, the theater project, will be anchored there, and we'll be having some exhibits and displays there as well. It's the usual problem that all the money to do all this stuff happens too late to actually spend intelligently. And so you're running madly around trying to put something together at the last minute that should have been planned 2 years earlier. So that's a bit of a problem. But there will be a kind of off-site site for World Urban Forum on the Great Northern Way campus with various exhibits and displays and activities. We just had a meeting with the province last week about trying to upgrade that and make it a more expansive demonstration for the World Urban Forum. But, you know, it's not very far away. Yes? Absolutely. The question here was, what about 10 or 15 years down the road in terms of the workplace and what that will be like, and thinking creatively and innovatively about that. This is actually something we're really interested in. We started a discussion with Hayworth, which is a company that does everything inside the exterior walls of the building. So the demising, the interior partitions, all the furniture, space planning, and so on. And we have actually quite an exciting set of projects with them on exactly that issue. We've also been talking to TELUS about their future-friendly home and office of the future. You may have seen ads for in the television. So we're quite interested in trying to think through, especially space issues, because they're so crucial. Issues to do with satisfaction. We think food provision and eating spaces may have quite a lot to do with how people interact with their work environment and how happy they are. So we're interested in working on that question. We're really interested in the role of technology and engaging the user in being part of the building and having some control over their workspace, both spatially but also in terms of airflow. And so we think there can be ways, but to some extent, they'll depend on the sort of creativity of the people involved in doing this. That's why we want private sector partners who have a financial interest in the, in selling things in the future along this line, but also the occupants who have a direct interest in having a nice place to work. So it's a crucial issue, and we have to address it. Three more questions. Okay. Yes.
Okay. I was a volunteer here on campus with a small research group who moved into
Right. So the question is, why are so many green buildings horrible places to be? Is that fair? Well, this started in the 70s. Remember sick air syndrome? And in Ottawa, les terrasses de la Chaudière, sealed buildings. I mean, they put in order to save energy, they completely sealed them. You couldn't open the window, and people just started choking and getting sick. So there's a long tradition of this. That doesn't happen anymore because lessons have been learned. Now one of the big problems is acoustics in these buildings because they're all concrete floors, and they're often open concept in order to allow natural ventilation, and so you can't hear yourself think. Other problems. There's a lot of problems with green buildings. That's why we say humane has to be equally as important as green. And we have to figure out how to do this. We still need to do those things, or achieve those goals at least, but we need to do them in ways that people feel comfortable with. And we think empowering people, the occupants, making them part of the system, having some control over it, instead of being excluded. See, the issue is, you want the building to perform. So you don't want all these occupants screwing it up by, you know, interfering with anything. So you leave them out and you optimize at the building scale. We think that's backwards. What we need to do is say to the occupants, no, we're going to give you control, more control over your own work environment. In return, please be part of a collective effort to make the whole system work. We don't know if that will work, but we think it's a more promising avenue. Right. And the key is you have to think about those things. They have to be part of the design process. If you're only focusing on the system performance, you're not thinking about the people, that's what's going to happen. We've been talking quite a lot about this issue. How do you bring the human into the design process from the beginning so those kinds of things don't happen? We'll see. It's certainly part of our agenda. Yeah. Right.
And wood is not a sustainable approach. That we need something like earth. Growing trees, you can only do it a certain number of times. Every time you remove a tree, you're removing the soil, is really what's happening.
Right. The question is, what about rammed earth, cob houses, and other forms of sustainable building materials and design practices? Yes? Right. I think what you see out in the housing industry and in the commercial building industry, which are rather different, is a whole bunch of design solutions being tested and tried. Cob is not going to work for a 68,000 square foot building that holds a couple of hundred people. It may work really well in other circumstances. So our claim is not that this is the kind of building technology that should be used in housing, for example, or in even very different scale commercial buildings. There's different approaches in different circumstances. The claim I would make, however, is that on a life cycle analysis, measuring the actual environmental and social impact of building systems, this makes sense from a sustainability point of view. So, of course, opinions can differ on that, but we plan to at least make the case in terms of measurement of impacts and life cycle assessment of impacts, and then people can decide whether they agree or disagree. 20 years from now, what the right technology is, we'll see. I certainly wouldn't claim that this is what we'll be doing. We'll be doing it exactly this way 20, 30 years from now. What I do claim, though, on that front is we want to build SIRS in a modular way. We're putting shear panels in so you can actually deconstruct the building, and we can do plug and play and move different kinds of systems in and out. So we will be trying alternatives to what we start with. But we think we're pretty comfortable with the choices we've made. The people involved, by the way, are pretty deeply engaged in the Canadian Green Building Council, in the LEEDS program, in the green building industry in BC, both on the academic side and on the market side. So to some extent, I'm relying on their expertise and capability, but I'm pretty comfortable doing that. Yes. The question was about geothermal energy. Yes, we'll have ground source heat pumps. We'll do the main cooling and heating for the building. So we will have a field. We'll be drilling and putting wells down and heat pump technology for the main heating and cooling load. Terrace and Utilities Services is very interested in that technology. That's one of the reasons they've offered to buy all the energy and water systems in the building and run it as a utility for us. So, yes, on geothermal. That was the third, but there was one last one that right here. I wonder if I can just add, because the hand was up for a while. Yes, sir.
Yes, I too am very excited about the program. I wondered whether, because of the depth and the sophistication in your planning, whether perhaps you could encourage the CBC with you to come up with progress reports
. We do plan, of course, a webcam of the construction process so people can follow it as it comes out of the ground. We have a proposal for an hour-long documentary with small interstitial video clips with Knowledge Network, which we haven't got funded yet. We're trying to document the process because we think actually the human process of this is the most important part of it. The technology is kind of glitzy, but it's really about people getting together, working this out. So we've had some filming by BCIT, and we have some students documenting the process. But I'd like to move more down that path in the direction that you're talking about. We just haven't yet been able to make that work. I think that's it.
John Hepburn was to have been here to thank the speaker, but I'm not sure he is, and so Tony Arrott will thank our speaker this evening.
Thank you, John Robinson. That was an exciting glimpse into the future, and I think that the future really belongs to people who can lead us there, who have the vision and are willing to dedicate their lives to trying to pull something like this off. And it takes a great deal of optimism, enthusiasm. I think you have them all. We have a great stake in your success. And on behalf of the Vancouver Institute, I thank you for the talk, and I thank you for what you're doing for all of us.